Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with Diane de las Casas, author of Dinosaur Mardi Gras. And we'll hear some special Valentine's Day poetry from poet Guion Smith. Diane de las Casas is one of those people you meet and don't forget. Her warm and vibrant personality spills over into whatever story she's telling, and she tells a lot of stories. She's an award-winning performer and the author of many children's picture books, as well as professional books for teachers and storytellers. Her two most recent books are Blue Frog, The Legend of Chocolate, illustrated by Holly Stone Barker, and today we're talking about Dinosaur Mardi Gras, illustrated by Marita Gentry. Diane, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Now, Mardi Gras is just an irresistible time for storytellers, isn't it?
Oh, it's so much fun. I mean, when we're in New Orleans, we like to party, and carnival season is here, so it's a great time to tell stories.
Now, tell us about Dinosaur Mardi Gras and how you got this idea.
My nephew had to do this shoebox float project that so many children in New Orleans do around Mardi Gras season. And so he built this double-decker dinosaur Mardi Gras float. And I looked at it and I was like, wow, that is so cool. That should be a book. So I went and started researching dinosaurs. And I'm telling you, the story came to me in one sitting. That rarely happens. But It just came to me, like the rhythm, the rhyme. And I'm so inspired by all of the Mardi Gras songs and jazz. So it's got a really nice little rhythmic section in the story that kids can participate in. It's a lot of fun.
And you have instructions for kids to make that dinosaur float,
don't you? I do, because you know what I found out in doing my research? That is something that is very peculiar to New Orleans, not even the rest of Louisiana, that in New Orleans, the school children here do that. They have contests and they do little parades where they have their little shoebox floats. So I thought this is a great way to introduce children around the world to Mardi Gras.
And now you have the crew of T-Rex and they make small floats too, which I loved.
That's the other aha moment I had, because Rex is the king of carnival and T-Rex is the king of carnivores. I was like, it's a no-brainer, Rex and Rex.
Now, you've had a lot of illustrators over the course of your books, and it's always important to get the illustrations right in a Mardi Gras book. So how does that work for you when you're working with illustrators?
Well, Marita's wonderful, and I've done many books with her, so we kind of have a groove. But she came into New Orleans. She lives in the Baton Rouge area, and she went all over the city, and she took pictures. And a couple of years in a row, I went and took pictures of all the floats in the Rex Parade, and I sent her all of these pictures so we could have the real flavor of Mardi Gras in the book.
And people who do books for children always seem to feel a special responsibility to get into classrooms and libraries and tell the stories to kids. And you've just begun doing that with this book. So what has the response been like so far?
Oh, it's been great. Everybody loves carnival, even outside of New Orleans. It's a lot of fun. And I'm going to Tennessee in May, and they've chosen Dinosaur Mardi Gras as their theme for this reading festival that I'm doing. So they're going to have the kids doing a parade. I think people just are really attracted to that whole carnival culture. And the other thing I want to show children is that carnival, at least in New Orleans, is not just about the fun and the parades and the partying, that we have a beautiful tradition behind it. So I really get to talk about that and how it's very family oriented.
And there's so much you can learn from the stories of Mardi Gras itself. I mean, every parade is a story, you know, almost every float can tell a story, and every family builds these stories into their Mardi Gras experience. It's just a big kind of densely woven time, you know?
In my family, we like to dress up. So on Carnival Day, you'll see us parading around in themed costumes every year. It's just so much fun. You never know who I might be.
Okay, well, watch out. Now, that's not the only thing that's a family affair at your house. Writing is a family affair,
it
too,
is.
Right?
And illustrating. Mm-hmm. My 11-year-old daughter is Kid Chef Eliana, and she has authored a cookbook, and she does all kinds of cooking demonstrations and book signings, and she's even cooked with the esteemed chef John Besh. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. She has a resume that's out of this world. My oldest daughter is in her senior year, about to graduate from LSU with a degree in graphic design and illustration, and she did Eliana's cookbook. She's done several of my professional books, and she's doing Eliana's second cookbook, which should be coming out hopefully this year.
Oh, that's great. So how did you get into storytelling in the first place? You were a Navy brat, right? And so
yes.
You lived in lots of different places. So how did you kind of zero in on storytelling?
My mom's from the Philippines. My stepdad is Cajun. My father's Caucasian. So I come from this very multinational family. And stories and food are really the binding glue in family. So I grew up with lots of family stories. In 1993 or so, I started volunteering at my local library because since I was in second grade, I've always wanted to write children's books. And I was submitting my stuff and getting lots of rejections. I mean, I have a binder full.
Aww.
So I decided to volunteer at my local library to improve my writing because if I was around children's books and if I did storytelling, then I would really get to know what the children liked to read and what they responded to. So I did this for a couple of years. I would go into my local library. They loved me because I would plan the story time. I did all the work.
Right.
But I also had all the fun. Mm-hmm. So and then it got to be like I planned the story time, I selected all the books, I did the crafts, and then I could see a difference when I would tell my favorite stories if I would just tell the story versus reading the story out loud. And I could see the difference in their faces. Like there was mm-hmm. just this really wonderful connection that I had with them. So I began putting the books down and I began telling stories. So I would do like a couple of oral stories and then I would do some story performances from the actual book. And my audiences grew and grew, and the library had this big crowd on Saturday story times. And the librarian said, Diane, you should do this as a living. And I said, what? A professional storyteller? That's like a real job?
Mm-hmm.
She said, oh, yeah, the library pays people to do that. And I'm like, oh, and I'm doing this for free? So I went home, and I told my husband, I said, you know what? I think I know what I really want to do. And at this point, I was working for attorneys. I was a legal secretary, office manager, paralegal. So I had a really nice, well-paying job. And I came home and told my husband, babe, I want to be a professional storyteller. He's like, what's that?
Oh.
Wait, you just quit Mary Kay.
Oh, no.
Are you sure you want to do that? I was trying to find myself. And I was like, no, this is it. This is what I want to do. So I created some letterhead and business cards, and I pounded the pavement. I went to the Children's Museum. And then within the year, I was invited to tell at Jazz Fest. And from there, it's been growing. And now mm-hmm. I travel all over the world.
Well, you do have that passionate belief in what stories can do for us.
Yes.
And I think everybody feels that when they're around you. And that's all part of your website, which is storyconnection.net, too.
Yes. The other thing I like to do is I really like to provide teachers, educators, and librarians with more than what they can just find in my books. All of my books are designed as what I call tell-along tales because I'm a storyteller. And so there's participation in them. But I also provide free activities that go along with all of the books
mm-hmm.
so that teachers and librarians can work with the kids and, you know, like with Dinosaur Mardi Gras, they can make the Dinosaur Mardi Gras masks. There are 18 different masks and doubloons that the kids can make on paper plates.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a lot of fun doing that. I really am passionate about literacy.
Mm-hmm.
Passionate.
You can tell. Oh, you can meet Diane de las Casas when she signs Dinosaur Mardi Gras Thursday, February 16th at 6 p.m. at Barnes & Noble Metairie. And check out that website, storyconnection.net. Diane, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Susan. Laissez le bon temps rugir. Let the good times roar.
Down in New Orleans where the blues was born, it takes a cool cat to blow a horn. On the sound and Rampart Street, the combo's playing the mambo beat. Mardi Gras, mambo, 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 Mardi Gras.
body clap mambo, 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 body clap mambo, down in New Orleans.
Guion Smith is a New Orleans poet who achieved national recognition when he read his Katrina poem, O Beautiful Storm, at the opening of the second season of the HBO series Tremé. It's a heart-wrenching poem that grew from the depths of Guion Smith's own experience, but he's here with us on Valentine's Day to talk about love poetry. Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Great. Welcome to The Reading Life. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So when did you start writing poetry?
I actually started writing love poetry about age 14 or 15. None of it still exists.
Oh, no.
It's all locked away in a box that will not be opened unless Pandora comes back to retrieve it. I started writing professionally, I guess you could say, right after Katrina. I was displaced for a couple of months, and I really, you know, had a connection with the city that, you know, was latent until that point. And then when I came back, I really wanted to explore just, you know, being a part of the culture. And so that's when I started to really take on this craft in a serious way.
Mm-hmm. A Beautiful Storm was such a powerful poem that grew out of those experiences of that terrible time. And it was one that so many people could relate to. So how did you move on to love poetry for this event?
Well, I believe that all artists just have their own interpretations of everything about life. And so anything that affects my life or motivates me in life, you know, I'm going to have a perspective about it. P.T. Anderson, one of my favorite directors, did There Will Be Blood and Punch Drunk Love, which, mm-hmm. you know, they're both kind of odd movies, but, you know, one of them is his perspective on love, the other completely different. And in the same way, I like to have my poetry pretty much express whatever it is that I'm feeling, which, you know, there's obviously a whole range of emotions that you go through in life. And these poems that I'll actually be reciting for the Valentine's Day event, they also cover a lot of different aspects of love. They're not all happy or sappy or romantic. Some of them are very real interpretations of, you know, my observations or some of my own personal experiences with love.
What is it that makes a good love poem? How can you tell that you've got a good one?
I think just like any other poem, if you can see the author's personal experience, or I guess the speaker, not necessarily the author, you know, mm-hmm. sometimes you write from someone else's perspective, but if you can feel the speaker's perspective come out in the poem, if you can see the image clear, as well as if you can find a way to relate. And you know, all experiences aren't relatable, but to me, in any good work of art, there's something there that you can draw a kinship with. To me, that's what poetry really is about. Like, you know, I don't like to say poetry is good and or bad, but I feel poetry is good when there's something there that I can pull from it.
Right. You grew up as the son of an English professor. Your father's Felipe Smith, who teaches at Tulane. Was poetry part of your life?
Well, not exactly poetry. My dad, you know, he is an English professor, but he's more into prose and novels. Not to say that he doesn't have his own roots in poetry. He wrote a poem that was published, and I actually took from that poem some things that I liked and then wrote a poem that intermingled my own feelings as well as the things he was saying. He was talking about the city of New Orleans from his perspective in that era. And then I added my own feelings about it from the current New Orleans. But then a lot of it was overlapping, clearly, because, you mm-hmm. know, some things stay the same. But more often than not, he was handing me a book. You know, I kind of had to come upon the poetry on my own. I think it worked out better that way, you know, because then it was untainted. You know, I didn't have to rely on what I had gotten from him to try to create my own voice. I was able to explore a lot better that way.
And who are the poets who influence you the most?
Well, spoken word artists are probably those that I identify with best, just because that's what I do more so than just writing poetry. And there are a couple of them who have moved me. One guy is Talon Macy. One guy is Lionel King, who's a local New Orleans poet. Pretty much all the local New Orleans poets have influenced me in some way. Chuck Perkins, who I know has been on this show. You know, everybody that you hear doing your craft, they're going to shape it in some way, too. And then also, Mary Baraka is a big influence. And possibly the biggest influence for me in poetry was Nikki Giovanni. She spoke here in 2004, I believe, and I went to hear her speak, and the room literally had about 400 or 500 people, and she might have been the smallest, oldest person in the room, yet everybody was captivated. She was amazing. And it wasn't just poetry. It was her explication of her poetry. She would give you an explanation of what was going on, and you just thought she was on this rant about, you know, some random set of events that happened in her life. And then at the end of her quote-unquote rambling, she'd be like, okay, well, I wrote a poem about that. And then she'd recite the poem, and it was everything that she had just talked about, and it was amazing. And I really knew that I wanted to, you know, do public speaking, and even especially poetry, once I saw that event, you know, and it took Katrina happening for me to actualize that and not just think about it. But even now, I still think of how well she captured an audience when I'm sitting up there and, you know, I might be a little nervous. I'm like, well, if 4'10", 90 pound Nikki Giovanni can do it, then I can do it.
What would Nikki Giovanni do? Exactly.
Right, right.
She is a fierce and electric presence.
Oh, yeah.
She really is.
Absolutely.
And poets can do that. They can electrify us.
And I like that about poetry, that it gives you the opportunity to really affect people, you know, because like if you're a writer or if you direct and do things that take a lot longer to deliver your message, they can definitely be effective. But with poetry, you really can get somebody's attention really quickly and hit them hard and leave a mark. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's especially why I like poetry.
So what are you going to read for us today?
I thought I would recite this piece that I wrote, I think maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Funny story about it. Very good friend of mine from my college days liked this girl, and I guess she didn't know it, or maybe she kind of knew, but he never really talked about it with her. And he's like, Gian, I need a poem. I need to let this girl know how I feel about her. And I was like, okay, well, tell me how you feel about her. So then he's like, okay. And then he opens the door to his car, and we sit down in the car, and then he turns on this CD, and there's some guy who, this R&B artist, who I've not heard since, and he's singing this song. He's like, okay, that's how I feel. Now write that in a poem. I was like, all right, I'll see what I can do. So I wrote the poem, and when I finished it, I was like, man, I really like this. This is great. And I gave it to my friend, and he's like, oh, yeah, that's perfect. That's exactly how I feel. I'm like, okay, so when are you going to give it to her? He's like, well, I don't know if I'm going to give it to her. I'm like, what do you mean you're not going to give it to her? He's like, oh, no, I'm kind of scared. And I'm like, well, you know what? Give me my poem back. So now it's mine again. It's called She Smiles. My favorite thing about all my memories is your smile. Your first day of school, it's nice to meet you, smile. Your first day back at school, I haven't seen you in a while, smile. Your congratulations on our graduation, smile. Your, I know they got guys all over your college campus, but I can tell you've been thinking about me the whole while, smile. And it's true. Because whether I was dancing at a party with another girl, thinking about how she couldn't compare to your smile, or chilling in the boot looking at average chicks by the pile, smiles, or up in House of Blues with girls that just don't have your style, smile, or even some of the girls I kicked it with who just don't have that get me riled, smile. The only one who's always been on my mind is you. You've got that save it for a rainy day, lock that up on file, smile. That soul of Mother Africa, straight from the banks of the River Nile, smile. That lonely nights, there's only one number I wanna dial, smile. That I've been walking the earth and ain't seen nothing like that in a million miles, smile. That this platonic stuff is driving me wild, smile. So forget about friends, I want you to have my firstborn child, smile. That get on one knee in front of your parents, your friends, and Jesus to ask, can we take this walk down the aisle, smile? Because, baby, for real, that's all I want to do.
Well, every woman in this room is smiling right now. Thank you so much. I hope you have a wonderful Valentine's Day. Tell us a little bit about this event tonight.
It's going to be at Cafe Istanbul, 2372 St. Claude in the Healing Center. The event will actually be preceded by a couple of poets before me, and they will be speaking on a whole range of love-related topics. Some of them happy, some of them perhaps a little bitter, but fun. Then I'll come on, I'll do a set. I'm going to be accompanied by Mario Abney and the Mario Abney Quintet. Mario is also featured on HBO's Treme. He's one of the musicians, the very, very short guy with the dreadlocks and plays the trumpet. And so his quintet is going to be playing behind me. And then after I'm done, he'll follow up with some jazz interpretations of some popular love songs. Should be pretty good. I'll also be screening a video that I shot, which is just one of my poems, and also a short film, very short, maybe 12, 15 minutes, that I also did.
Jazz and love poetry and peek at new work doesn't get any better. Tickets are available at the door tonight. Kyan Smith, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to you, too.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. For a sweet, sweet Valentine's Day, join today's guest poet, Kyan Smith, and a host of others, performing with the Mario Abney Quintet for Roses and Violets, an evening of poetry and jazz, Tuesday, February 14th at 8:30 p.m. at Cafe Istanbul in the New Orleans Healing Center. For ticket info, check out rosesviolets.eventbrite, that's BRITE.com. And the New Orleans Museum of Art Book Group meets Wednesday, February 15th at noon in the NoMA Library. Readers can choose one or read both of these books. Rogue's Gallery, The Secret Story of Lust, Lies, Greed, and Betrayals That Made the Metropolitan Museum of Art by Michael Gross. Or Making the Mummies Dance, Inside the Metropolitan Museum of Art by Thomas Hoving. Contact librarian Sheila Cork at 504-658-4117 or write scork at noma.org for more information. Today's guest, Diane de las Casas, signs Dinosaur Mardi Gras, Thursday, February 16th at 6 p.m. at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Michael Patrick Welch appears Thursday, February 23rd from 6 to 8 p.m. at Ogden After Hours at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, along with a full complement of literary musicians. CNN weather anchor Bonnie Schneider signs Extreme Weather, a guide to surviving flash floods, tornadoes, hurricanes, snowstorms, tsunamis, and other natural disasters, Thursday, February 23rd at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. James Farwell signs The Pakistan Cauldron, Conspiracy, Assassination, and Instability, Saturday, February 25th at 1 p.m. at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org or email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.